Okay, any preliminary questions or issues? Okay, we left off last time getting ready to talk about the elevator case, Murphy. And again, we're reviewing the way in which the res ipsa loquitur doctrine can be used to establish negligence. Ms. Meyer, can you tell us about Murphy? Okay, and for our purposes, we're looking at that first assignment of error, which is the refusal to give a res ipsa instruction. What does a plaintiff need to show in order to have the trial judge instruct the jury on the doctrine of res ipsa? Okay, second. And third, or any other third party. Okay, so again, we've sufficiently eliminated other plausible explanations. How are we doing on the first one? How clear is it that this is that elevators don't ordinarily fail to level unless somebody's negligently adjusted them? How about item number two? Who else controlled the elevator besides one? Okay, and there's kind of equivocal evidence on this. The question about the relationship between the... You need some? John's going to call in an airstrike, I think, with it. Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. All right. Meanwhile, so the question is, how exclusive was the elevator company's control? And their argument was what? Well, I'm run that past me again. Just on the issue of res ipsa, that is, should the judge have instructed on res ipsa, the plaintiff's entitled to a res ipsa instruction if they meet those criteria. With respect to the second criterion, the defendant's argument is that they don't have exclusive control. Well, it's not so much that Humana should have contacted them, but remember what we're dealing with here is we don't really know what caused this elevator to mislevel. We don't know whether, you know, there was dust in the, you know, or somebody dropped a wrench on one of these things, or we just don't know why it is that this thing misleveled. So rather than being able to say, on this occasion, Humana should have called them, the point is, why did it mislevel in the first place? And we're trying to figure out, do we know that the negligence, assuming under criterion number one, we can logically infer somebody was negligent here because these things just don't happen unless there's been negligence. How convinced are we that it was the elevator company, not Humana, whose negligence caused the accident? And the elevator company's argument is, look, we're not the only people messing with that elevator. Humana does a lot of the routine maintenance. We get called in for, you know, sort of major service calls, but it's like when the copy machine breaks, you know, there are people who will go in there and pull the paper out and, you know, restock the toner and so forth. Yeah, when the thing really breaks down, we call the, you know, the person from the copier repair place, but we sort of share responsibility for keeping this in operation. So it's not so much, gee, these people should have called the specialist, but rather we don't know who caused this accident, and we simply can't make the logical inference, well, it must have been the negligence of the elevator company, because for that matter, it might have been the negligence of the hospital. Question, why didn't the plaintiff name the hospital as well in a kind of Ibarra versus Spangard case? It may be that she thought Ibarra versus Spangard was not a good precedent. On the other hand, the relationship between the hospital and the elevator company was reasonably close, such that but there's another reason why she didn't name the hospital as a defendant. Ms. Riseborough? Well, people actually do sue their employers for things like, you know, missed wages discrimination or other kinds. There are cases where people do sue their employer, but not this kind of case. Although it may be that she was afraid of biting the hand that fed her. Mr. Sharma? What she would like to do, obviously, is the expression travelers sometimes use, is that you put two cats in the bag and you shake the bag up, you know, and hope they'll start clawing at each other. You name the hospital and the elevator company as defendants, and they start blaming each other, and the plaintiff sits back and applauds. Ms. Schmidt? Yeah, there's a special deal. The tort system has this little anomaly here where you can't sue your employer for accidental injuries. Typically, as we'll talk about in Chapter 4, the employer is covered by a statute that replaces the tort system with this automatic compensation feature, which is sort of good news and bad news. You get these automatic benefits. You don't have to prove fault. You can even admit your own fault. Yeah, I wasn't watching where I was going and I fell down the stairs. If I'm on the job, my employer has to provide workers' compensation coverage for that. The bad news is that the schedule of benefits under a workers' comp plan is typically very modest. It's wage replacement and medical bills, and even at that, the employer oftentimes will resist paying what the employee claims is due to the injury on the job. You have litigation over the scope of workers' comp coverage. But the theory is that the workers' comp system does a better job of compensating for injuries that happen on the job than allowing a tort system in which the employee sues the employer, tries to prove the employer is at fault, the employer has would have different defenses like assumption of risk or contributory negligence or all sorts of other things. So around the turn of the, about 1910 or so, most states shifted from a fault-based system for on-the-job injuries to a workers' comp system. Again, we'll pick that up again in Chapter 4. But there is just this, hitch in the giddy-up here where she couldn't sue her employer, and that would have actually made it a little bit easier to kind of say, I don't know who of you is responsible for this, but somebody here was negligent. Okay, any questions about Murphy or about workers' comp in general, not workers' comp, about res ipsa in general before we move on to Walmart? She probably already did get workers' comp coverage. See, again, that's the good news about workers' comp coverage and the reason why it was thought to be an improvement over the tort system, that the tort system has this long delay on it. Even if I've got a good claim from the time I'm injured until the time I finally either settle my claim or have a jury award damages and I collect on that judgment, you can be talking years. Whereas the workers' comp system, in theory, provides me with a more or less not instantaneous, but timely compensation for my injury. And again, in sort of in the big picture scheme of things, one of the proposals for the tort system would be to move towards something more like a workers' comp system. Various kinds of automobile insurance plans have been described as no-fault plans, where you try to move away from a fault-based system towards something more like the workers' comp system, and some people think that's great for the reasons they like workers' comp, and other people think this is terrible. Again, it's something to think about. Okay, our next, thinking of this as kind of filling up our tool belt here of pliers and vice grips and screwdrivers and soldering irons and things like that. We've talked about statutory violations and industry custom and jury experience and res ipsa. Now we're going to talk about evidence of the defendant's own safety policies and using those to establish the negligence of the defendant. Mr. Fisher, why don't you tell us about Smith? So when the case goes to trial, what's the point of controversy here? Okay, and why don't you give us the general rule on that? Again, this is sort of bottom line or kind of bold print of what we're looking at here. If a plaintiff wants to offer evidence of what are called post-accident repairs or subsequent remedial measures, as in this case, she slips and falls, then they bring the mats out, and the plaintiff wants to use that evidence of what they did after the accident to show that they were negligent, the ordinary rule is, yeah, that kind of evidence, post-accident repairs or subsequent remedial measures, are inadmissible . So what happened here, she was apparently allowed to use that evidence, and isn't the defendant justified in complaining about that? Yeah? Well, there are exceptions. I mean, we find this evidence inadmissible except in certain cases. What are the cases in which post-accident repairs may come in to establish that the defendant... Yeah, Ms. Cazzuela? Okay. I'll just put ownership, there's more to it, control, all that sort of stuff. But where the... And I might preface this by saying each of these exceptions is, in effect, triggered by some action of the defendant. That is, the plaintiff can't wake up and say, gee, I'd like to use this evidence. I'm going to use it for this purpose. The plaintiff, in effect, has to wait for the defendant to do something to trigger the exception. And the defendant can trigger that by, in effect, contesting ownership or control. As an example, if the suppose the Walmart was in some kind of a shopping center where you had a whole bunch of different stores, and the defendant had, the plaintiff had slipped and fallen in some on the sidewalk someplace, and when the plaintiff sued the defendant Walmart, Walmart's response was, that accident occurred on a part of the shopping center that we did not control. It wasn't our responsibility to keep that area safe. If the defendant denies ownership and the plaintiff says, but I want to use the evidence of their post-accident repair to show that their behavior contradicts, in effect, their denial of ownership or control, then if the plaintiff is using it for that purpose, the court will let it in. So that's exception number one. If the defendant denies ownership or control, and the plaintiff then offers the evidence to show ownership or control. Was anybody in this case denying Walmart's ownership or control of the... No. So that... exception won't work. What's the second exception that will allow this evidence to be used? Yeah, Mr. Fisher. Okay. And again, if feasibility is contested, so let's say the a plaintiff says that the defendant should have taken some safety precaution, and the defendant's response is, oh, no, we couldn't do that. It would prevent us from doing whatever it is we need to do. For example, there was a case in Washington involving a guy injured when he was a clerk at a motel, and... The motel was robbed, and he complained about it, said they needed bulletproof glass for him, and the motel franchise or whatever said no thanks. He was robbed again, and this time he was shot, And so the motel then installed bulletproof glass. Now, at the trial of the case, the plaintiff said it was negligent for you not to have installed bulletproof glass, and the motel's first response was, well, wait a second, what kind of message does it send? How feasible is it to have bulletproof, you know, as you come to check into the motel and you see the clerk is, you know, do the rest of the rooms have bulletproof glass here? You know, what kind of a place am I checking into? This may be the Hotel California you can check out, but you can never leave. And so, again, if the defendant says, no, this is the thing you're asking for is not feasible, the plaintiff can say, but wait a minute, you did the very thing you're now claiming you couldn't do. So, again, if the defendant says, well, we couldn't use mats at the front entrance, it would keep the doors from opening and, you know, it would actually make things more slippery and so forth and so on, mats would be a bad idea, the plaintiff can use the post-accident repair to show feasibility. Was there any issue about feasibility in this case? Was the defendant saying, no, we couldn't have used mats, they would have messed things up? No. That doesn't work either. Well, but we were down to our third strike. Hopefully we can do better than the Mariners do with their third strike here. What's the last exception to the rule? Yes, sir. Okay. And a more general argument would be that the defendant, let me put it this way, that the defendant, like John Weingartner, opened the door. Convenient little prop there. So solve the mystery here, John. What's the mystery here? Yeah. Too many copies. That was the. That's right. Yeah. Thank you. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So the third argument is in effect. Well, ordinarily we wouldn't let the plaintiff do this, but if the defendant opens the door to this, that is, the defendant has already raised the issue about the post-accident repair, or is otherwise denied that they ever did such a thing, then the plaintiff is entitled to walk through that door. You often hear that expression in criminal cases, for example, where the defendant doesn't testify, you can't bring up bad things that the defendant has done before or said before, but if the defendant in a criminal case chooses to testify, you can then impeach the defendant through showing that in the past they've done terrible things. That's a whole complicated part of the evidence rules and is often a big factor in choosing whether or not you're going to have the defendant testify. Okay, so did the defendant in this case open the door to testimony about the mats? Mr. Bischoff, you're shaking, you're nodding your head there. Okay, in that sense, it may fall under a different rule, which is sort of the acquiescence rule or the estoppel rule, that going back to the turntable case, if the defendant doesn't object to something in a timely way, they waive that, or if they expressly waive something as they did in the turntable case. But here, apparently, the store manager was one of the people who was talking about this, and so the plaintiff said, fine, we'll talk about it too. So again, there was both a combination of acquiescence and sort of the defendant opening the door here, such that the plaintiff was not out of bounds in using this evidence against the defendant. But again, the general rule that we have is that this kind of evidence is inadmissible. Tell me the reason for that. Why is it that we generally have a a restriction on use of evidence. Ms. Kelly? Actually, they're just to be difficult. You're right, but I'll be difficult here to say there is in fact an incentive. If you're Walmart and you have discovered that somebody slipped and fallen in the vestibule of your store, you do have an incentive to put the mats down. What would that be? Yeah. You may decide, hey, maybe that past one we can't do anything about, but we don't want any more people slipping and falling and suing us. But you're right about the general idea that certainly punishing people for doing this would reduce the incentive. It would create a disincentive for everybody saying, hey, let's put some mats out. It will prevent future slip and falls. The lawyer may be saying, but watch out, the doing that is going to make you look bad. So the legal system, conscious of its potential to act in a negative way or create a negative disincentive, says ordinarily we won't permit you to use post-accident repairs to establish that the behavior prior to the accident was negligent. Obviously, it's not that you can't show that the failure to use mats was negligent. You can show that a reasonably prudent person would have done it, and so forth and so on. The one, so to speak, the one tree of whose fruit you may not eat is that to try to show that the defendant, after the accident, did this remedial measure. Okay. Now, continuing in my effort to sort of be, controversial, provocative here, I give you this subsequent case or second case of Stevens versus Boston Elevated Railway to say here again we have the defendant taking a precautionary measure, and the question is, can the plaintiff take advantage of this precautionary measure to help convince the jury that the defendant acted negligently? Mr. Palmer, can you tell us about Stevens? Okay, so again, the defendant has a policy or has taken a safety precaution to try to reduce accidents. The defendant tells its employees, ring the gong as you approach an intersection to warn traffic coming in the other direction, and in this case, they didn't do it. Is that evidence admissible against the defendant? Okay, why?
Well, the defendant failing to observe.
Okay, there's sort of an analogy here or an extension, all sort of a third-party beneficiary concept, sort of, that as the employee owes a duty to his employer to ring this bell, so the employee, in effect, owes that duty not just to the employer, but to the public as a whole. But I, again, to be difficult here, why doesn't this fall under the same heading as the post-accident repairs, namely things that the defendant is doing that benefits society, that is adopting a higher standard of safety, and we're kicking him in the teeth for it? We're biting the hand that feeds us, in effect. Won't employers, faced with this rule, stop issuing safety policies? Instead of having a rule book that has helpful guidance to the employees, employers will, essentially say, be careful in general terms and won't hurt themselves by adopting safety policies which, if broken, will be used against the employer. Doesn't the same logic apply? Okay. And what difference does that make? Why does timing matter? Okay, but what's wrong with my logic that says if allowing evidence of post-accident repairs will discourage defendants from taking safety measures, which is something society benefits from, why isn't it similarly a bad idea to, in effect, punish employers who have safety rules? Yeah, Ms. Moody? But isn't there the recognition of putting the mats out after Mrs. Smith has fallen in the Walmart that too is a recognition that, gee, we should have had these out? That's precisely why the plaintiff wants to use it, because it's sort of an admission of guilt almost. Ms. Ma? Well, I think I don't know if vicarious liability provides you with any extra kick here, and we're sort of lurching over into vicarious liability, which is not a bad thing. We eventually have to get there, but I'm not sure that the fact that the employee is subject to is subject to vicarious liability for what the employee does. Again, what I'm trying to figure out is whether we can identify a difference between the disincentive to have post-accident repairs as distinguished from the disincentive to have a rule book. Mr. Breck? I'm sure I've lost track of which is former and which is latter. Well, there's sort of, if I understand you correctly, there's sort of good news, bad news in the trolley case. The good news is that the employer is doing the right thing by having a safety policy. If I understand what you're saying, it would in many ways be even worse if they didn't have the policy. So the good news is, in one sense, is the employer has a policy. The bad news is, because they have a policy, the employee's failure to follow that policy stands out in sharper relief. If there were no policy and we simply had to start from ground zero to say, would a reasonable person ring the gong as they're approaching the intersection, that's a more difficult general case to make. Whereas it's shooting fish in a barrel if you have a policy in place and the employee fails to follow it. Now, I'm not sure there is a distinction aside from the timing issue, but the timing issue has proven to be persuasive to courts to essentially cleave these two kinds of rules and to say, on the one hand, with respect to post-accident repairs, we won't ordinarily let that in, but they've all agreed that with respect to safety policies adopted before the accident, I sometimes call these rule book violations, just as a sort of shorthand. You'll see them on a checklist. But the point is that these are the kinds of cases where the employer, or for that matter, the employees, have some kind of standard operating procedure. This is the way we do this particular thing. It's kind of like industry custom only brought down to a smaller venue or social world. In this case, there is a sort of clear pattern of what reasonable people do. The employees themselves or the employer has figured out this is the smart way to do this. And the employee's failure to follow that is a very persuasive piece of evidence to show that the defendant or the employee didn't act safely. Now, unlike, as I think the case makes clear, unlike those cases where where there's a statute where the duty is imposed not by the employer, but the duty is imposed by the legislature, by the law, if you're in a Cardozo jurisdiction, there's this kind of certainty or conclusive quality to a statute, whereas the employer's policy is simply persuasive evidence. If the defendant succeeds in showing that the policy they adopted was not one necessary for safety, for example, but was just something they customarily did. So, for example, if you're running a trolley company and you have a rule that says if you're not behind schedule and you have an elderly or infirm passenger getting on or off the trolley, take a moment to help that person on or off the trolley. It's good for PR. Helps us, you know, stay popular with the citizenry, with our customer base. But if somebody doesn't follow that policy and an elderly or infirm passenger trips and falls, and they try to use, well, you had a policy where you were supposed to help elderly infirm people. Well, that wasn't for safety purposes. We weren't negligent for failing to do that. Yeah, we like to do that as kind of a goodwill gesture, but we're not negligent just because we didn't follow that policy. The defendant may persuade the jury our failure to follow our own policy does not establish negligence. It wasn't our fault. But again, if you're the plaintiff, you'd love to see something like a rule book of violation, because it puts the defendant in the very awkward position of saying, we adopted a policy that had nothing to do with safety or with the standard of reasonable care. Typically, the defendant is going to look pretty bad when they don't even follow their own standard. Okay? So, again, the rules on these are fairly clear and mechanical. Post-accident repairs, inadmissible, except subject to those three exceptions. Rule book violations are admissible. They're all fair game. Okay. Mr. How do you say your last name? Jakes, okay. Because in the long run, having a rule book will reduce the number of accidents. It'll help me discipline my employees, and I'm probably stuck with it anyway. So if I run, you know, I run a grocery business, it's Safeway, and I have truck drivers, I have a couple of rules. You know, one is stay sober while you're driving. You know, another one is don't speed. Another rule, you know, for example, don't cut people off in traffic. Or, you know, I basically provide a series of rules. Now, it may be that I will be discouraged as an employer from those kinds of bonus marginal ones, helping elderly passengers on or off, you know, stop by the side of the road if you see somebody who's, in an automobile accident. If you're driving a Safeway truck, we want you to stop and help these people out. I may think twice about whether I want to have a rule like that because it could come back to haunt me. So there may in fact be some disincentive, but it's going to occur starting with those rules like don't drive drunk, which it doesn't hurt me in the least to have such a rule because my employee is going to be found negligent anyway for failing to do that, and I want something very clearly in my handbook that emphasizes the importance of that rule, and similarly other kinds of rules which I figure to myself, it's not like this is going to be any big, it's not like I have any hope of defending one of my employees who does one of these things. I mean, the employer then, I mean, again, the way personal injury lawsuits work, the funding, in effect, comes from the insurance company. It's the insurance policy, or big defendants, you know, Gonzaga University or Safeway or whatever, may have a significant amount of self-insurance. So that, you know, it's either a very big deductible, or there are all kinds of different ways to run the insurance game. But typically, the insurance money pays. Now, the employee is typically worthless from the standpoint of getting a significant recovery. And let's say, for example, I'm the coach of the volleyball team, and I'm driving the van full of my volleyball players to University of Montana for a volleyball game, and I commit some act of negligence. In fact, it turns out I'm intoxicated while I'm driving this van, and I get into an accident. In theory, the employer could have some standing rule that says, oh, by the way, if you violate these rules, you have to pay us back when we get held liable. But typically, the employee doesn't have insurance for that. And what's the, you know, most of us, aside from our insurance, aren't worth much. So as a practical matter, the theoretical right of the employer to recover from the employee just sort of gets, you know, tossed on the discard pile because there's typically nothing there. Theoretically, you could have something like that, but as a practical matter, it doesn't work. Okay, so again, we've kind of been, yeah, go ahead. Yes. Right. Yes. Well, then it's for the jury to decide. Again, yeah, the jury could look at that and say, again, unlike the Cardozo grabbing the jury by the, you know, collar and forcing them to do something they may or may not want to do, these things are merely persuasive. So the plaintiff can use that, but the defendant may come back and say, hey, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the question is whether we were using reasonable care for the plaintiff's safety, And sure, we had a rule that says if you see somebody by the side of the road, pull over and see if you can offer them any assistance, but that's not, you know, within the scope of our acting in some way that's dangerous. That was a purely PR kind of move on our part. Now, the plaintiff can come back and say, oh, no, it wasn't, you know, but again, that's a, you're in the realm of argument there rather than being able to use one of these things in a kind of coercive way that, again, a plaintiff would love to have in a Cardozo-type situation. Okay, Mr. Phillips? Yeah. Ah. Now, it's really a rule of evidence, and just for what it's worth. You have heard this in other contexts. Like you watch TV shows or whatever, and you hear that objection, and you're on an object that's cumulative. What that means is it's kind of a piling on, and typically, if you hear one witness say the defendant was speeding, and then you have another witness who says the defendant was speeding, and then you have a third witness who says, you know, at a certain point the defendant says, Your Honor, we've now, of course, the plaintiff will then turn to the defendant and say, oh, so you admit you were speeding? You know, the moment you roll over and play dead, I'll stop putting on more. But the trial judge will also say, you know, we're burning daylight here. And I think you've made your point, and I'm not going. I will sustain the objection that further testimony to this effect is cumulative. So again, it's a kind of time-saving measure on the part of the court and judgment call about when that applies. But that's an evidence rule for another day. Okay, so I just have a few more minutes here. Rather than getting into, I always like to come back from a weekend talking about drunken lawyers, but I'll have to wait till Tuesday to do that. But just again to kind of see this in the bigger scheme of things, the stuff we've been doing to date has been an effort to establish negligence on the part of the defendant. And this next section is no longer looking at was somebody negligent. It's not even looking at whether the employer was negligent. What we're looking to find is that the employer is legally, vicariously liable for the negligence of an employee. That's the critical question. So, in a way, what we're doing in this next little section, it actually falls under a different legal heading, the heading of what's called the law of agency. And there's a, I think it's actually taught in the class called business associations. But there's a lot of stuff in the law of agency. For example, you know, when are you liable for what your salespeople commit you to, and you know, what happens if somebody makes a deal that's not really, you know, authorized and that sort of thing. The law of agency is a broad kind of way of attaching what the agent does to some typically deep pocket principle. So again, what we're looking for in the next section is if the employee does something stupid, how do I know that the employer is responsible for it? And sometimes it's obvious, it's an easy question, but in other cases it's much more difficult. I guess we'll basically pick up with that on tomorrow.